And now, it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hello, I'm June Pinnell Stevens. Today I'll be reading the book Petronella by Jay Williams. In the kingdom of Sky Clear Mountain, three princes were always born to the king and queen. The oldest prince was always called Michael. The middle prince was always called George, and the youngest was always called Peter. When they were grown, they always went out to seek their fortunes. What happened to the oldest prince and the middle prince, no one ever knew. But the youngest prince always rescued a princess, brought her home, and in time ruled over the kingdom. That was the way it had always been, and so far as anyone knew, that was the way it would always be. Until now. Now was the time of King Peter the 26th and Queen Blossom. An oldest prince was born, and a middle prince, but the youngest prince turned out to be a girl. "Well," said the king gloomily, "we can't call her Peter. We'll have to call her Petronella. And what's to be done about it, I'm sure I don't know." There was nothing to be done. The years passed, and the time came for the princes to go out and seek their fortunes. Michael and George said goodbye to the king and queen and mounted their horses. Then out came Petronella. She was dressed in traveling clothes, with her bag packed and a sword by her side. "If you think," she said, "that I'm going to sit at home, you are mistaken. I'm going out to seek my fortune, too." "Impossible," said the king. "What will people say?" cried the queen. "Look," said Prince Michael, "be reasonable, pet. Stay home. Sooner or later a prince will turn up here." Petronella smiled. She was a tall, handsome girl with flaming red hair, and when she smiled in that particular way, it meant she was trying to keep her temper. "I'm going with you," she said. "I'll find a prince if I have to rescue one from something myself, and that's that." The grooms brought out her horse. She said goodbye to her parents, and away she went behind her two brothers. They traveled into the flatlands below Sky Clear Mountain. After many days, they entered a great dark forest. They came to a place where the road divided into three, and there at the fork sat a little wrinkled old man covered with dust and spider webs. Prince Michael said haughtily, "Where do these roads go, old man?" "The road on the right goes to the city of Graz," the man replied. "The road in the center goes to the castle of Blitz. The road on the left goes to the house of Albion the Enchanter, and that's one." "What do you mean by 'and that's one'?" asked Prince George. "I mean," said the old man, "that I'm forced to sit on this spot without stirring, and that I must answer one question from each person who passes by. And that's two." Petronella's kind heart was touched. "Is there anything I can do to help you?" she asked. The old man sprang to his feet. The dust fell from him in clouds. "You have already done so," he said, "for that question is the one which releases me. I have sat here for 62 years waiting for someone to ask me that." He snapped his fingers with joy. "In return, I will tell you anything you wish to know." "Where can I find a prince?" Petronella said promptly. "There is one in the house of Albion the Enchanter," the old man answered. "Ah," said Petronella, "then that is where I am going." "In that case, I will leave you," said her oldest brother, "for I am going to the castle of Blitz to see if I can find my fortune there." "Good luck," said Prince George, "for I am going to the city of Graz. I have a feeling my fortune is there." They embraced her and rode away. Petronella looked thoughtfully at the old man, who was combing spider webs and dust out of his beard. "May I ask you something else?" she said. "Of course, anything." "Suppose I wanted to rescue that prince from the enchanter. How would I go about it? I haven't any experience in such things, you see." The old man chewed a piece of his beard. "I do not know everything," he said after a moment. "I know that there are three magical secrets, which, if you can get them from him, will help you." "How can I get them?" asked Petronella. "Offer to work for him. He will set you three tasks, and if you can do them, you may demand a reward for each. You must ask him for a comb for your hair, a mirror to look into, and a ring for your finger." "And then?" "I do not know. I only know that when you rescue the prince, you can use these things to escape from the enchanter. It doesn't sound easy, sighed Petronella.
Nothing we really want is easy, said the old man. Look at me. I've wanted my freedom, and I've had to wait 62 years for it.
Petronella said goodbye to him. She mounted her horse and galloped along the third road. It ended at a low, rambling house with a red roof. It was a comfortable-looking house, surrounded by gardens and stables and trees heavy with fruit. On the lawn, in an armchair, sat a handsome young man with his eyes closed and his face turned to the sky. Petronella tied her horse to the gate and walked across the lawn. "Is this the house of Albion the Enchanter?" she said. The young man blinked up at her in surprise.
I think so, he said. Yes, yes, I'm sure it is.
And who are you?
The young man yawned and stretched. I am Prince Ferdinand of Firebright, he replied. Would you mind stepping aside? I'm trying to get a suntan, and you're standing in the way.
Petronella snorted. You don't sound like much of a prince, she said.
That's funny, said the young man, closing his eyes. That's what my father always says.
At that moment, the door of the house opened. Out came a man dressed all in black and silver. He was tall and thin, and as sinister as a cloud full of thunder. His face was stern, but full of wisdom. Petronella knew at once that he must be the enchanter. He bowed to her politely. What can I do for you?
I wish to work for you, said Petronella boldly.
Albion nodded. I cannot refuse you, he said. But I warn you, it will be dangerous. Tonight I will give you a task. If you do it, I will reward you. If you fail, you must die. Petronella glanced at the prince and sighed. If I must, I must, she said. Very well. That evening they all had dinner together in the enchanter's cozy kitchen. Then Albion took Petronella out to a stone building and unbolted its door. Inside were 7 huge black dogs. You must watch my hounds all night, said he. Petronella went in, and Albion closed and locked the door. At once the hounds began to snarl and bark. They showed their teeth at her. But Petronella was a real princess. She plucked up her courage. Instead of backing away, she went toward the dogs. She began to speak to them in a quiet voice. They stopped snarling and sniffed at her. She patted their heads. I see what it is, she said. You're lonely here. I will keep you company. And so all night long, she sat on the floor and talked to the hounds and stroked them. They lay close to her, panting. In the morning, Albion came out and let her out.
Ah, said he, I see that you are brave. If you had run from the dogs, they would have torn you to pieces. Now you may ask for what you want.
I want a comb for my hair, said Petronella. The enchanter gave her a comb carved from a piece of black wood. Prince Ferdinand was sunning himself and working at a crossword puzzle. Petronella said to him in a low voice, I am doing this for you.
That's nice, said the prince. What's selfish in 9 letters?
You are, snapped Petronella. She went to the enchanter. I will work for you once more, she said. That night, Albion led her to a stable. Inside were 7 huge horses. Tonight, he said, you must watch my steeds. He went out and locked the door. At once the horses began to rear and neigh. They pawed at her with their iron hooves. But Petronella was a real princess. She looked closely at them and saw that their coats were rough and their manes and tails full of burrs. I see what it is, she said. You are hungry and dirty. She brought them as much hay as they could eat and began to brush them. All night long she fed them and groomed them, and they stood quietly in their stalls. In the morning, Albion let her out. You are as kind as you are brave, said he. If you had run from them, they would have trampled you under their hooves. What will you have as a reward?
I want a mirror to look into, said Petronella.
The enchanter gave her a mirror made of gray silver. She looked across the lawn at Prince Ferdinand. He was doing setting-up exercises. He was certainly handsome. She said to the enchanter, I will work for you once more. That night, Albion led her to a loft above the stables. There, on perches, were 7 great hawks. "Tonight," he said, "you must watch my falcons." As soon as Petronella was locked in, the hawks began to beat their wings and scream at her. Petronella laughed. "That is not how birds sing," she said. "Listen." And she began to sing in a sweet voice. The hawks fell silent. All night long she sang to them, and they sat like feathered statues on their perches, listening. In the morning Albion said, "You are as talented as you are kind and brave. If you had run from them, they would have pecked and clawed you without mercy. What do you want now?" "I want a ring for my finger," said Petronella. The enchanter gave her a ring made from a single diamond. All that day and all that night, Petronella slept, for she was very tired. But early the next morning, she crept into Prince Ferdinand's room. He was sound asleep, wearing purple pajamas. "Wake up," whispered Petronella. "I'm going to rescue you." Ferdinand awoke and stared sleepily at her. "What time is it?" "Never mind that," said Petronella. "Come on."
"But I'm sleepy," Ferdinand objected, "and it's so pleasant here."
Petronella shook her head. "You're not much of a prince," she said grimly, "but you're the best I can do." She grabbed him by the wrist and dragged him out of bed. She hauled him down the stairs. His horse and hers were in a separate stable, and she saddled them quickly. She gave the prince a shove, and he mounted. She jumped on her own horse, seized the prince's reins, and away they went like the wind. They had not gone far when they heard a tremendous thumping. Petronella looked back. A dark cloud rose behind them, and beneath it she saw the enchanter. He was running with great strides, faster than the horses could go. Petronella desperately pulled out the comb. "The old man said this would help me," she said, and because she didn't know what else to do with it, she threw the comb on the ground. At once a forest rose up. The trees were so thick that no one could get between them. Away went Petronella and the prince. But the enchanter turned himself into an axe and began to chop. Right and left he chopped, flashing, and the trees fell before him. Soon he was through the wood, and once again Petronella heard his footsteps thumping behind. She reined in the horses. She took out the mirror and threw it on the ground. At once a wide lake spread out behind them, gray and glittering. Off they went again, but the enchanter sprang into the water, turning himself into a salmon as he did so. He swam across the lake and leaped out of the water onto the other bank. Petronella heard him coming thump, thump behind them again. This time she threw down the ring. It didn't turn to anything, but lay shining on the ground. The enchanter came running up, and as he jumped over the ring, it opened wide and then snapped up around him. It held his arms tight to his body in a magical grip from which he could not escape. "Well," said Prince Ferdinand, "that's the end of him." Petronella looked at him in annoyance. Then she looked at the enchanter, held fast in the ring. "Bother," she said. "I can't just leave him here. He'll starve to death." She got off her horse and went up to him. "If I release you," she said, "will you promise to let the prince go free?" Albion stared at her in astonishment. "Let him go free," he said. "What are you talking about? I'm glad to get rid of him." It was Petronella's turn to look surprised. I don't understand," she said. "Weren't you holding him prisoner?" "Certainly not," said Albion. "He came to visit me for a weekend, and at the end of it he said, 'It's so pleasant here. Do you mind if I stay on for another day or two?' I'm very polite, and I said, 'Of course.' He stayed on and on and on. I didn't like to be rude to a guest, and I couldn't just kick him out. I don't know what I'd have done if you hadn't dragged him away." "But then why did you come running after him this way?" "I wasn't chasing him," said the enchanter. "I was chasing you. You are just the girl I've been looking for. You are brave and kind and talented and beautiful as well." "Oh," said Petronella. I see," she said. "Hmm," she said. "How do I get this ring off you?" "Give me a kiss." She did so. The ring vanished from around Albion and reappeared on Petronella's finger. "I don't know what my parents will say when I come home with you instead of a prince," she said. "Let's go and find out, shall we?" said the enchanter cheerfully. He mounted one horse and Petronella the other, and off they trotted side by side,
leaving Prince Ferdinand of Firebright to walk home as best he could. You've been listening to the book Petronella by Jay Williams, published by Parents Magazine Press. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska, Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tanella. And I'm June Pinnell Stevens.
And now it's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, I'm Ron Clark, and today I'll be reading from the book The Twits by Roald Dahl. What a lot of hairy-faced men there are around nowadays. When a man grows hair all over his face, it's impossible to tell what he really looks like. Perhaps that's why he does it. He'd rather you didn't know. Then there's the problem of washing. When the very hairy ones wash their faces, it must be as big a job as when you and I wash the hair on our heads. So what I want to know is this. How often do all these hairy-faced men wash their faces? Is it only once a week, like us, on Sunday nights? And do they shampoo it? Do they use a hair dryer? Do they rub hair tonic in to stop their faces from going bald? Do they go to a barber to have their hairy faces cut and trimmed, or do they do it themselves in front of the bathroom mirror with nail scissors? I don't know. But next time you see a man with a hairy face, which will probably be as soon as you step out onto the street, maybe you'll look at him more closely and start wondering about some of these things. Mr. Twit was one of these very hairy-faced men. The whole of his face, except for his forehead, his eyes, and his nose, was covered with thick hair. The stuff even sprouted in revolting tufts out of his nostrils and ears. Mr. Twit felt that this hairiness made him look terrifically wise and grand, but in truth, he was neither of these things. Mr. Twit was a twit. He was born a twit, and now at the age of 60, he was a bigger twit than ever. The hair on Mr. Twit's face didn't grow smooth and matted as it does on most hairy-faced men. It grew in spikes that stuck out straight like the bristles of a nail brush. And how often did Mr. Twit wash this bristly, nail-brushy face of his? The answer is never, not even on Sundays. He hadn't washed it for years. As you know, an ordinary unhairy face like yours or mine simply gets a little smudgy if it isn't washed often enough, and there's nothing so awful about that. But a hairy face is a very different matter. Things cling to hairs, especially food. Things like gravy go right in among the hairs and stay there. You and I can wipe our smooth faces with a washcloth, and we quickly look more or less all right again, but the hairy man can't do that. We can also, if we're careful, eat our meals without spreading food all over our faces, but not so the hairy man. Watch carefully next time you see a hairy man eating his lunch, and you'll notice that if he even opens his mouth very wide, it's impossible for him to get a spoonful of beef stew or ice cream and chocolate sauce into it without leaving some of it on the hairs. Mr. Twit didn't even bother to open his mouth wide when he ate. As a result, and because he never washed, there were always hundreds of bits of old breakfasts and lunches and suppers sticking to the hairs around his face. They weren't big bits, mind you, because he used to wipe those off with the back of his hand or on his sleeve while he was eating. But if you looked closely, not that you'd ever really want to, you'd see tiny little specks of dried-up scrambled eggs stuck to the hairs and spinach and tomato ketchup and fish sticks and minced chicken livers and all the other disgusting things Mr. Twit liked to eat. If you looked closer still, hold your noses, ladies and gentlemen, if you peered deep into the mustachy bristles sticking out over his upper lip, you would probably see much larger objects that had escaped the wipe of his hand, things that had been there for months and months, like a piece of maggoty old green cheese or a moldy old cornflake, or even the slimy tail of a tinned sardine. Because of all this, Mr. Twit never really went hungry. By sticking out his tongue and curling it sideways to explore the hairy jungle around his mouth, he was always able to find a tasty morsel here and there to nibble on. What I'm trying to tell you is that Mr. Twit was a foul and smelly old man. He was also an extremely horrid old man, as you'll find out in a moment. Mrs. Twit was no better than her husband. She did not, of course, have a hairy face. It was a pity that she didn't, because that, at any rate, would have hidden some of her fearful ugliness. The funny thing is that Mrs. Twit wasn't born ugly. She'd had quite a nice face when she was young. The ugliness had grown upon her year by year as she got older. Why would that happen? I'll tell you why. If a person has ugly thoughts, it begins to show on the face. And when that person has ugly thoughts every day, every week, every year, the face gets uglier and uglier until it gets so ugly you can hardly bear to look at it. A person who has good thoughts cannot ever be ugly. You can have a wonky old nose and a crooked mouth and a double chin and stick-out teeth, but if you have good thoughts, they'll shine out of your face like sunbeams, and you'll always look lovely. Nothing good shone out of Mrs. Twit's face. In her right hand she carried a walking stick. She used to tell people that this was because she had warts growing on the sole of her left foot and walking was painful. But the real reason she carried a stick was so that she could hit things with it, things like dogs and cats and small children. And then there was the glass eye. Mrs. Twit had a glass eye that was always looking the other way. You can play a lot of tricks with a glass eye because you can take it out and pop it back in any time you like. You can bet your life Mrs. Twit knew all of those tricks. One morning she took out her glass eye and dropped it into Mr. Twit's mug of beer when he wasn't looking. Mr. Twit sat there drinking the beer slowly. The froth made a white ring on the hairs around his mouth. He wiped the white froth onto his sleeve and wiped his sleeve on his trousers. "You're plotting something," Mrs. Twit said, keeping her back turned so he wouldn't see that she had taken out her glass eye. "Whenever you go all quiet like that, I know very well you're plotting something." Mrs. Twit was right, of course. Mr. Twit was plodding away like mad. He was trying to think up a really nasty trick he could play on his wife that day. "You'd better be careful," Mrs. Twit said, "because when I see you starting to plot, I watch you like a wombat." "Oh, do shut up, you old hag," Mr. Twit said. He went on drinking his beer, and his evil mind kept working away on the latest horrid trick he was going to play on the old woman. Suddenly, as Mr. Twit tipped the last drop of beer down his throat, he caught sight of Mrs. Twit's awful glass eye staring up at him from the bottom of the mug. It made him jump. "I told you I was watching you," cackled Mrs. Twit. "I've got eyes everywhere, so you'd better be careful." To pay her back for the glass eye and his beer, Mr. Twit decided he would put a frog in Mrs. Twit's bed. He caught a big one down by the pond and carried it back secretly in a box. That night, when Mrs. Twit was in the bathroom getting ready for bed, Mr. Twit slipped the frog between her sheets. Then he got into his own bed and waited for the fun to begin. Mrs. Twit came back and climbed into her bed and put out the light. She lay there in the dark, scratching her tummy. Her tummy was itching. Dirty old hags like her always have itchy tummies. Then all at once she felt something cold and slimy crawling over her feet. She screamed.
"What's the matter with you?" Mr. Twit said.
"Help!" screamed Mrs. Twit, bouncing about. "There's something in my bed!"
"I'll bet it's that giant skilly-wiggler I saw on the floor just now," Mr. Twit said.
"That what?" screamed Mrs. Twit.
"I tried to kill it, but it got away," Mr. Twit said. "It's got teeth like screwdrivers."
"Help!" screamed Mrs. Twit. "Save me! It's all over my feet!"
"It'll bite off your toes," said Mr. Twit.
Mrs. Twit fainted. Mr. Twit got out of bed and fetched a jug of cold water. He poured the water over Mrs. Twit's head to revive her. The frog crawled up from under the sheets to get near the water. It started jumping about on the pillow. Frogs love water. This one was having a great time. When Mrs. Twit came to, the frog had just jumped onto her face. This is not a nice thing to happen to anyone in bed at night. She screamed again.
"By golly, it is a giant skilly-wiggler," Mr. Twit said. "It'll bite off your nose."
Mrs. Twit leaped out of bed and flew downstairs and spent the night on the sofa. The frog went to sleep on her pillow. The next day, to pay back Mr. Twit for the frog trick, Mrs. Twit sneaked out into the garden and dug up some worms. She chose big, long ones and put them in a tin and carried the tin back to the house under her apron. At 1 o'clock, she cooked spaghetti for lunch, and she mixed the worms in with the spaghetti, but only on her husband's plate. The worms didn't show because everything was covered with tomato sauce and sprinkled with cheese.
"Hey, my spaghetti's moving," cried Mr. Twit, poking around in it with his fork.
"What's a new kind?" Mrs. Twit said,
taking a mouthful from her own plate, which of course had no worms.
"It's called squiggly spaghetti. It's delicious. Eat it up while it's nice and hot."
Mr. Twit started eating, twisting the long tomato-covered strings around his fork and shoveling them into his mouth. Soon there was tomato sauce all over his hairy chin.
"It's not as good as the ordinary kind," he said, talking with his mouth full. "It's too squishy."
"I find it very tasty," Mrs. Twit said.
She was watching him from the other end of the table. It gave her great pleasure to watch him eating worms.
"I find it rather bitter," Mr. Twit said. "It's got a distinctly bitter flavor. Buy the other kind next time."
Mrs. Twit waited until Mr. Twit had eaten the whole plateful. Then she said,
"You want to know why your spaghetti was so squishy?"
Mr. Twit wiped the tomato sauce from his beard with a corner of the tablecloth.
"Why?" he said. "And why had it a nasty, bitter taste? Why?" he said.
"Because it was worms!" cried Mrs. Twit,
clapping her hands and stamping her feet on the floor and rocking with horrible laughter. To pay Mrs. Twit back for the worms in his spaghetti, Mr. Twit thought up a really clever, nasty trick. One night when the old woman was asleep, he crept out of bed and took her walking stick downstairs to his work shed. There he stuck a tiny round piece of wood, no thicker than a penny, onto the bottom of the stick. This made the stick longer, but the difference was so small, the next morning Mrs. Twit didn't even notice it. The following night, Mr. Twit stuck on another tiny bit of wood. Every night he crept downstairs and added an extra tiny thickness of wood to the end of the walking stick. He did it so very neatly that the extra bits looked like a part of the old stick. Gradually, but oh so gradually, Mrs. Twit's walking stick was getting longer and longer. Now, when something is growing very slowly, it's almost impossible to notice it happening. You yourself, for example, are actually growing taller every day that goes by, but you wouldn't think it, would you? It's happening so slowly that you can't even notice it from one week to the next. It was the same with Mrs. Twit's walking stick. It was all so slow and gradual that she didn't notice how long it was getting, even when it was halfway up to her shoulder.
"That stick's too long for you," Mr. Twit said to her one day.
"Why, so it is," Mrs. Twit said, looking at the stick. "I've had a feeling there was something wrong, but I couldn't for the life of me think what it was."
"There's something wrong, all right," Mr. Twit said, beginning to enjoy himself.
"What can have happened?" Mrs. Twit said, staring at her old walking stick. "It must suddenly have grown longer."
"Don't be a fool," Mr. Twit said. "How can a walking stick possibly grow longer? It's made of dead wood, isn't it? Dead wood can't grow."
"And what on earth has happened?" cried Mrs. Twit.
"It's not the stick. It's you," said Mr. Twit, grinning horribly. "It's you that are getting shorter. I've been noticing it for some time now."
"That's not true," cried Mrs. Twit.
"You're shrinking, woman," said Mr. Twit.
"It's not possible."
"Oh, yes, it jolly well is," said Mr. Twit. "You're shrinking fast. You're shrinking dangerously fast. Why, you must have shrunk at least a foot in the last few days."
"Never," she cried.
"Of course you have. Take a look at your stick, you old goat, and see how much you've shrunk in comparison. You've got the shrinks. That's what you've got. You've got the dreaded shrinks."
Mrs. Twit began to feel so trembly that she had to sit down. As soon as Mrs. Twit sat down, Mr. Twit pointed at her and shouted,
"There you are. You're sitting in your old chair, and you've shrunk so much your feet aren't even touching the ground."
Mrs. Twit looked down at her feet, and by golly, the man was right. Her feet were not touching the ground. Mr. Twit, you see, had been just as clever with the chair as he'd been with the walking stick. Every night when he had gone downstairs and stuck a little bit extra onto the stick, he had done the same to the four legs of Mrs. Twit's chair.
"Just look at you sitting there in your same old chair," he cried, "and you've shrunk so much your feet are dangling in the air."
Mrs. Twit went white with fear.
"You've got the shrinks," cried Mr. Twit,
pointing his finger at her like a pistol.
"You've got them badly. You've got the most terrible case of shrinks I have ever seen."
Mrs. Twit became so frightened she began to dribble. But Mr. Twit, still remembering the worms in his spaghetti, didn't feel sorry for her at all.
"I suppose you know what happens to you when you get the shrinks," he said.
"What?" gasped Mrs. Twit. "What happens?"
"Your head shrinks into your neck, and your neck shrinks into your body, and your body shrinks into your legs, and your legs shrink into your feet. And in the end, there's nothing left except a pair of shoes and a bundle of old clothes."
"I can't bear it," cried Mrs. Twit.
"It's a terrible disease," said Mr. Twit. "The worst in the world."
"How long have I got?" cried Mrs. Twit. "How long before I finish up as a bundle of old clothes and a pair of shoes?"
Mr. Twit put on a very solemn face.
"At the rate you're going," he said, shaking his head sadly, "I'd say not more than 10, or maybe 11 days."
"But isn't there anything we can do?" cried Mrs. Twit.
"There's only one cure for the shrinks," said Mr. Twit.
"Tell me," she cried. "Oh, tell me quickly."
"We'll have to hurry," said Mr. Twit.
"I'm ready. I'll hurry. I'll do anything you say," cried Mrs. Twit.
"You won't last long if you don't," said Mr. Twit, giving her another grisly grin.
"What is it I must do?" cried Mrs. Twit, clutching her cheeks.
"You've got to be stretched," said Mr. Twit.
Mr. Twit led Mrs. Twit outdoors, where he had everything ready for the great stretching. He had 100 balloons and lots of string. He had a gas cylinder for filling the balloons, and he had fixed an iron ring into the ground.
"Stand here," he said,
pointing to the iron ring. He then tied Mrs. Twit's ankles to the iron ring. When that was done, he began filling the balloons with gas. Each balloon was on a long string, and when it was filled with gas, it pulled on its string, trying to go up and up. Mr. Twit tied the ends of the strings to the top half of Mrs. Twit's body. Some he tied around her neck, some under her arms, some to her wrists, some even to her hair. Soon there were 50 colored balloons floating in the air above Mrs. Twit's head.
"Can you feel them stretching you?" asked Mr. Twit.
I can, cried Mrs. Twit. "They're stretching me like mad."
He put on another 10 balloons. The upward pull became very strong. Mrs. Twit was quite helpless now. With her feet tied to the ground and her arms pulled upward by the balloons, she was unable to move. She was a prisoner, and Mr. Twit had intended to go away and leave her like that for a couple of days and nights, just to teach her a lesson. In fact, just as he was about to leave, Mrs. Twit opened her big mouth and said something silly.
"Are you sure my feet are tied properly to the ground?" she gasped. "If those strings around my ankles break, it'll be goodbye for me."
And that's what gave Mr. Twit his second nasty idea.
"There's enough pull here to take me to the moon," Mrs. Twit cried out.
"To take you to the moon," exclaimed Mr. Twit. "What a ghastly thought. We wouldn't want anything like that to happen. Oh, dear me, no."
"We most certainly wouldn't," cried Mrs. Twit. "Put some more string around my ankles quickly. I want to feel absolutely safe."
"Very well, my angel," said Mr. Twit, and with a ghoulish grin on his lips, he knelt to her feet.
He took a knife from his pocket, and with one quick slash, he cut through the strings holding Mrs. Twit's ankle to the iron ring. She went up like a rocket.
"Help!" she screamed. "Save me!"
But there was no saving her now. In a few seconds, she was high up in the blue, blue sky and climbing fast. Mr. Twit stood below, looking up.
"What a pretty sight," he said to himself. "How lovely all those balloons look in the sky. And what a marvelous bit of luck for me. At last the old hag is lost and gone forever."
Mrs. Twit may have been ugly and she may have been beastly, but she was not stupid. High up there in the sky, she had a bright idea.
"If I can get rid of some of these balloons," she said to herself, "I will stop going up and start to come down."
She began biting through the strings that held the balloons to her wrists and arms and neck and hair. Each time she bit through a string and let the balloon float away, the upward pull got less and her rate of climb slowed down. When she had bitten through 20 strings, she stopped going up altogether. She stayed still in the air. She bit through one more string. Very, very slowly she began to float downward. It was a calm day and there was no wind at all, and because of this, Mrs. Twit had gone absolutely straight up. She now began to come absolutely straight down. As she floated gently down, Mrs. Twit's petticoat billowed out like a parachute, showing her long knickers. It was a grand sight on a glorious day, and thousands of birds came flying in from miles around to stare at this extraordinary old woman in the sky. Mr. Twit, who thought he had seen his ugly wife for the last time, was sitting in the garden celebrating with a mug of beer. Silently, Mrs. Twit came floating down. When she was at about the height of the house above Mr. Twit, she suddenly called up at the top of her voice,
"Here I come, you grisly old grunion, you rotten old turnip, you filthy old frumpet!"
Mr. Twit jumped as though he'd been stung by a giant wasp. He dropped his beer. He looked up. He gaped. He gasped. He gurgled. A few choking sounds came out of his mouth.
"Ugh," he said. "Ugh!
I'll get you for this," shouted Mrs. Twit.
She was floating down right on top of him, and she was purple with rage and slashing the air with her long walking stick, which she had somehow managed to hang onto all the time.
"I'll swish you to a swazzle," she shouted. "I'll swash you to a swizzle. I'll gnash you to a nozzle. I'll nosh you to a nozzle."
And before Mr. Twit had time to run away, this bundle of balloons and petticoats and fiery fury landed right on top of him, lashing out with the stick and cracking him all over his body. But that's enough of that. We can't go on forever watching these two disgusting people doing disgusting things to each other. We must get ahead with the story. Let's talk about their house, Mr. and Mrs. Twit's house and garden. some house. It looks like a prison, and not a window anywhere.
"Who wants windows?" Mr. Twit had said when they were building it. "Who wants every Tom, Dick, and Harry peeping in to see what you're doing?"
It didn't occur to Mr. Twit that windows were meant mainly for looking out of, not looking into. "And what about that ghastly garden?" Mrs. Twit was the gardener. She was very good at growing thistles and stinging nettles.
"I always grow plenty of spiky thistles and plenty of stinging nettles," she used to say. "They keep out nasty, nosy little children."
Near the house was Mr. Twit's workshed. To one side there was the big dead tree. It never has any leaves on it because it's dead. And not far from the tree was the monkey cage. There are 4 monkeys in it. They belong to Mr. Twit. You'll hear about them later. You've been listening to a story from the book The Twits by Roald Dahl, published by Alfred A. Knopf of New York. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan. The executive producer is Carla Tonella, and I'm Ron Clark. It's time for the Northern Storyteller. Hi, I'm Ron Clark, and today I'll be reading from the book The Twits by Roald Dahl. Once a week on Wednesdays, the Twits had bird pie for supper. Mr. Twit caught the birds, and Mrs. Twit cooked them. Mr. Twit was good at catching birds. On the day before Bird Pie Day, he would put the ladder up against the big dead tree and climb into the branches with a bucket of glue and a paintbrush. The glue he used was called Hug Tight, and it was stickier than any other glue in the world. He painted it along the tops of all the branches, and then he went away. As the sun went down, birds would fly in from all around to roost for the night in the big dead tree. They didn't know, poor things, that the branches were all smeared with the horrible Hug Tight. The moment they landed on a branch, their feet stuck, and that was that. The next morning, which was Bird Pie Day, Mr. Twit would climb up the ladder again and grab all the wretched birds that were stuck to the tree. It didn't matter what kind they were, song thrushes, blackbirds, sparrows, crows, little Jenny Wrens, robins, anything. They all went into the pot for Wednesday's bird pie supper. One Tuesday evening, after Mr. Twit had been up the ladder and smeared the tree with Hug Tight, 4 little boys crept into the garden to look at the monkeys. They didn't care about the thistles and the stinging nettles, not when they were monkeys to look at. After a while, they got tired of looking at the monkeys, so they explored further into the garden and found the ladder leaning against the big dead tree. They decided to climb it just for fun. There's nothing wrong with that. The next morning, when Mr. Twit went out to collect the birds, he found 4 miserable little boys sitting in the tree, stuck as tight as they could be by the seats of their pants to the branches. There were no birds because the boys' presence had scared them away. Mr. Twit was furious.
"As there are no birds for my pie tonight," he shouted, "then it'll have to be boys instead." He started to climb the ladder. "Boy pie might be better than bird pie," he went on, grinning horribly. "More meat and not so many tiny little bones."
The boys were terrified. "He's going to boil us," cried one of them. "He'll stew us alive," wailed a second. "He'll cook us with carrots," cried the third. But the 4th little boy, who had more sense than the others, whispered, "Listen, I've just had an idea. We're only stuck by the seats of our pants. So quick, unbutton your pants and slip out of them and fall to the ground." Mr. Twit had reached the top of the ladder and was just about to make a grab for the nearest boy when they all suddenly tumbled out of the tree and ran home with their naked bottoms winking at the sun. Now for the monkeys. The 4 monkeys in the cage in the garden were all one family. They were Mugglewump and his wife and their 2 small children. But what on earth were Mr. and Mrs. Twit doing with monkeys in their garden? Well, in the old days, they had both worked in a circus as monkey trainers. They used to teach monkeys to do tricks and to dress up in human clothes and to smoke pipes and all of the rest of that nonsense. Today, although they were retired, Mr. Twit still wanted to train monkeys. It was his dream that one day he would own the first great upside-down monkey circus in the world. That meant that the monkeys had to do everything upside down. They had to dance upside down, on their hands, with their feet in the air. They had to play football upside down. They had to balance one on top of the other upside down with Mugglewump at the bottom and the smallest baby monkey at the very top. They had to even eat and drink upside down, and that is not an easy thing to do because the food and water has to go up your throat instead of down it. In fact, it's almost impossible, but the monkeys simply had to do it, otherwise they got nothing to eat or drink. All this sounds pretty silly to you and me. It sounded pretty silly to the monkeys, too. They absolutely hated having to do this upside-down nonsense day after day. It made them giddy standing on their heads for hours on end. Sometimes the two small monkey children would faint with so much blood going to their heads. But Mr. Twit didn't care about that. He kept them practicing for 6 hours every day, and if they didn't do as they were told, Mrs. Twit would come running with her beastly stick. Mugglewump and his family longed to escape from the cage in Mr. Twit's garden and go back to the African jungle where they came from. They hated Mr. and Mrs. Twit for making their lives so miserable. They also hated them for what they did to the birds every Tuesday and Wednesday. "Fly away, birds," they used to shout, jumping about in the cage and waving their arms. "Don't sit on that big dead tree. It's just been smeared all over with sticky glue. Go and sit somewhere else." But these were English birds, and they couldn't understand the weird African language the monkeys spoke. So they took no notice and went on using the big dead tree, and they kept getting caught for Mrs. Twit's bird pie. Then one day a truly magnificent bird flew down out of the sky and landed on the monkey cage. "Good heavens!" cried all the monkeys together. "It's the roly-poly bird. What on earth are you doing over here in England, roly-poly bird?" Like the monkeys, the roly-poly bird came from Africa, and he spoke the same language as they did. "I've come for a holiday," said the roly-poly bird. "I like to travel." He fluffed his marvelous colored feathers and looked down rather grandly at the monkeys. "For most people," he went on, "flying away on holiday is very expensive, but I can fly anywhere in the world for nothing."
"Do you know how to talk to these English birds?" Mugglewump asked him.
"Of course I do," said the roly-poly bird. "It's no good going to a country and not knowing the language."
"Then we must hurry," said Mugglewump. "Today is Tuesday, and over there you can already see the revolting Mr. Twit up the ladder painting sticky glue on the branches of the big dead tree. This evening when the birds come in to roost, you must warn them not to perch on that tree, or they will be made into bird pie." That evening the roly-poly bird flew around and around the big dead tree, singing out,
"There's sticky stuff all over the tree. If you land in the branches, you'll never get free. So fly away, stay up high, or you'll finish up tomorrow in a hot bird pie."
The next morning when Mr. Twit came out with his huge basket to snatch all the birds from the big dead tree, there wasn't a single one on it. They were all sitting on top of the monkey cage. The roly-poly bird was there as well, and Mugglewump and his family were inside the cage, and the whole lot of them were laughing at Mr. Twit. Mr. Twit wasn't going to wait another week for his bird pie supper. He loved bird pie. It was his favorite meal. So that very same day he went after the birds again. This time he smeared all the top bars of the monkey cage with sticky glue, as well as the branches of the big dead tree.
"Now I'll get you," he said, "whichever one you sit on."
The monkeys crouched inside the cage watching all this, and later on when the roly-poly bird came swooping in for an evening chat, they shouted out, "Don't land on our cage, roly-poly bird. It's covered with sticky glue. So is the tree." And that evening as the sun went down and all the birds came in again to roost, the roly-poly bird flew around and around the monkey cage and the big dead tree, singing out his warning.
"There's sticky stuff now on the cage and the tree. If you land on either, you'll never get free. So fly away, stay up high, or you'll finish up tomorrow in a hot bird pie."
The next morning when Mr. Twit came out with his huge basket, not a single bird was sitting on either the monkey cage or the big dead tree. They were all perched happily on the roof of Mr. Twit's house. The roly-poly bird was up there as well, and the monkeys were in the cage, and the whole lot of them were hooting with laughter at Mr. Twit.
"I'll wipe that silly laugh off your beaks," Mr. Twit screamed at the birds. "I'll get you next time, you filthy, feathery frumps. I'll wring your necks, the whole lot of you, and have you bubbling in the pot for bird pie before this day is out."
"How are you going to do that?"
asked Mrs. Twit, who had come outside to see what all the noise was about.
"I won't have you smearing sticky glue all over the roof of our house."
Mr. Twit went very close to Mrs. Twit and lowered his voice so that neither the birds nor the monkeys would hear.
"I've got a great idea," he said. "We'll both go into town right away and we'll buy a gun each. How's that?"
"Brilliant!" cried Mrs. Twit, grinning and showing her long yellow teeth. "We'll buy those big shotguns that spray out 50 bullets or more in each bang."
"Exactly," said Mr. Twit. "Lock up the house while I go and make sure the monkeys are safely shut away."
Mr. Twit went over to the monkey cage. "Attention!" he barked in his fearsome monkey trainer's voice. "Upside down, all of you, and jump to it. One on top of the other. Quick! Get on with it or you'll feel Mrs. Twit's stick across your backsides." Obediently, the poor monkeys stood on their hands and clambered one on top of the other, with Mugglewump at the bottom and the smallest child at the very top.
"Now stay there till we come back," Mr. Twit ordered. "Don't you dare to move, and don't overbalance. When we return in 2 or 3 hours' time, I shall expect to find you all in exactly the same position as you are now. You understand?"
With that, Mr. Twit marched away. Mrs. Twit went with him, and the monkeys were left alone with the birds. As soon as Mr. and Mrs. Twit had disappeared down the road, the monkeys all flipped back onto their feet the right way up. "Quick, get the key," Mugglewump called out to the roly-poly bird who was still sitting on the roof of the house.
"What key?" shouted the roly-poly bird.
"The key to the door of our cage," cried Mugglewump. "It's hanging on a nail in the workshed. That's where he always puts it." The roly-poly bird flew down and came back with the key in his beak. Mugglewump reached a hand through the bars of the cage and took the key. He put it in the lock and turned it, and the door opened. All four monkeys leaped out together. "We're free," cried the two little ones. "Where shall we go, Dad? Where shall we hide?"
"Don't get excited," said Mugglewump. "Calm down, everybody. Before we escape from this beastly place, we have one very important thing to do."
"What?" they asked him.
"We're going to turn those terrible twits upside down."
"We're going to what?" they cried. "You must be joking, Dad."
"I'm not joking," Mugglewump said. "We're going to turn both Mr. and Mrs. Twit upside down with their legs in the air."
"Don't be ridiculous," the roly-poly bird said. "How can we possibly turn those two maggoty old monsters upside down?"
We can," cried Mugglewump. "We're going to make them stand on their heads for hours and hours, perhaps forever. Let them see what it feels like for a change."
"How?" said the roly-poly bird. "Just tell me how."
Mugglewump laid his head on one side, and a tiny twinkling little smile touched the corners of his mouth.
"Now and again," he said, "but not very often, I have a brilliant idea. This is one of them. Follow me, my friends, follow me." He scampered off toward the house, and the three other monkeys and the roly-poly bird went after him.
"Buckets and paintbrushes," said Mugglewump. "That's what we want next. There are plenty in the workshed. Hurry up, everyone. Get a bucket and a paintbrush."
Inside Mr. Twit's workshed, there was an enormous barrel of Hug-Tight sticky glue, the stuff he used for catching birds.
"Fill your buckets," Mugglewump ordered. "We're now going into the big house."
Mrs. Twit had hidden the key to the front door under the mat, and Mugglewump had seen her doing it, so it was easy for them to get in. In they went, all four monkeys with their buckets of sticky glue. Then came the roly-poly bird flying in after them with a bucket in his beak and a brush in his claw.
"This is the living room," announced Mugglewump, "the grand and glorious living room where those two fearful, frumptious freaks eat bird pie every week for supper."
"Please don't mention bird pie again," said the roly-poly bird. "It gives me the shudders."
"We mustn't waste time," cried Mugglewump. "Hurry up, hurry up. Now the first thing is this. I want everyone to paint sticky glue all over the ceiling. Cover it all. Smear it in every corner."
"Over the ceiling," they cried. "Why the ceiling?"
"Never mind why," shouted Mugglewump. "Just do as you're told and don't argue."
"But how do we get up there?" they asked. "We can't reach."
"Monkeys can reach anywhere," shouted Mugglewump. He was in a frenzy of excitement now, waving his paintbrush in his bucket and leaping about all over the room. "Come on, come on, jump on the table, stand on the chairs, hop on each other's shoulders. Roly-poly can do it flying. Don't stand there gaping. We have to hurry, don't you understand? Those terrible twits would be back any moment, and this time they'll have guns. Get on with it, for heaven's sake. Get on with it."
And so the great glue painting of the ceiling began. All the other birds who had been sitting on the roof flew in to help, carrying paintbrushes in their claws and beaks. There were buzzards, wild ducks, woodpeckers, magpies, rooks, ravens, and many more. Everyone was splashing away like mad, and with so many helpers, the job was soon finished.
"What now?" they all said, looking at Mugglewump.
"Aha!" cried Mugglewump. "Now for the fun. Now for the greatest upside-down trick of all time. Are you ready?"
"We're ready," said the monkeys. "We're ready," said the birds.
"Pull out the carpet," shouted Mugglewump. "Pull out this huge carpet from under the furniture and stick it to the ceiling."
"Onto the ceiling," cried one of the small monkeys. "But that's impossible, Dad."
"I'll stick you to the ceiling if you don't shut up," snapped Mugglewump.
"He's dotty," they cried. "He's balmy. He's batty. He's nutty. He's screwy. He's wacky."
"He's wacky," cried the roly-poly bird.
"Poor old Muggles has gone off his wump at last."
"Oh, do stop shouting such rubbish and give me a hand," said Mugglewump, catching hold of one corner of the carpet.
"Pull, you nitwits, pull."
The carpet was enormous. It covered the entire floor from wall to wall. It had a red and gold pattern on it. It's not easy to pull an enormous carpet off the floor when the room is full of tables and chairs. "Pull!" yelled Mugglewump. "Pull, pull, pull!" He was like a demon hopping around the room and telling everyone what to do, but you couldn't blame him. After months and months of standing on his head with his family, he couldn't wait for the time when the terrible twits would be doing the same thing. At least that's what he hoped. With the monkeys and the birds all pulling and puffing, the carpet was dragged off the floor and finally hoisted up onto the ceiling, and there it stuck. All at once, the whole ceiling of the living room was carpeted in red and gold. "Now the table, the big table!" shouted Mugglewump. "Turn the table upside down and put a dollop of sticky glue onto the bottom of each leg. Then we shall stick that onto the ceiling as well." Hoisting the huge table upside down onto the ceiling was not an easy job, but they managed it in the end. "Will it stay there?" they cried. "Is the glue strong enough to hold it up?" "It's the strongest glue in the world," Mugglewump replied. "It's the special bird-catching, bird-killing glue for smearing on trees."
"Please," said the roly-poly bird, "I have asked you before not to mention that subject. How would you like it if it was monkey pie they made every Wednesday and all your friends had been boiled up and I went on talking about it?"
"I do beg your pardon," said Mugglewump. "I'm so excited I hardly know what I'm saying. Now the chairs! Do the same with the chairs! All the chairs must be stuck upside down to the ceiling and in their right places. Oh, do hurry up, everybody. Any moment now those two filthy freaks are going to come rushing in with their guns." The monkeys, with the birds helping them, put glue on the bottom of each chair leg and hoisted them up to the ceiling. "Now the smaller tables," shouted Mugglewump, "and the big sofa, and the sideboard, and the lamps, and all these tiny little things, the ashtrays, the ornaments, and that beastly plastic gnome on the sideboard. Everything, absolutely everything, must be stuck to the ceiling." It was terribly hard work. It was especially difficult to stick everything onto the ceiling in exactly its right place, but they got it done in the end.
"What now?" asked the roly-poly bird.
He was out of breath and so tired he could hardly flap his wings.
"Now the pictures," cried Mugglewump. "Turn all the pictures upside down. And will one of you birds please fly out onto the road and watch to see when those frumptious freaks are coming back?"
"I'll go," said the roly-poly bird. "I'll sit on the telephone wires and keep guard. It'll give me a rest."
They had only just finished the job when the roly-poly bird came swooping in, screaming,
"They're coming back! They're coming back!"
Quickly, the birds flew back onto the roof of the house. The monkeys rushed into their cage and stood upside down, one on top of the other. A moment later, Mr. and Mrs. Twit came marching into the garden, each carrying a fearsome-looking gun.
"I'm glad to see those monkeys are still upside down," said Mr. Twit.
"They're too stupid to do anything else," said Mrs. Twit. "Hey, look at all those cheeky birds still up on the roof. Let's go inside and load our lovely new guns, and then it'll be bang, 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 and bird pie for supper."
Just as Mr. and Mrs. Twit were about to enter the house, two black ravens swooped low over their heads. Each bird carried a paintbrush in its claw, and each paintbrush was smeared with sticky glue. As the ravens whizzed over, they brushed a streak of sticky glue onto the tops of Mr. and Mrs. Twit's heads. They did it with the lightest touch, but even so, the Twits both felt it.
"What was that?"
cried Mrs. Twit.
"Some beastly bird has dropped his dirty droppings on my head."
"On mine, too," shouted Mr. Twit. "I felt it, I felt it."
"Don't touch it," cried Mrs. Twit. "You'll get it all over your hands. Come inside and we'll wash it off at the sink."
"The filthy, dirty brutes," yelled Mr. Twit. "I bet they did it on purpose. Just wait till I've loaded up my gun."
Mrs. Twit got the key from under the doormat, where Mugglewump had carefully replaced it, and into the house they went.
"What's this?" gasped Mr. Twit as they entered the living room.
"What's happened?" screamed Mrs. Twit.
They stood in the middle of the room looking up. All of the furniture, the big table, the chairs, the sofa, the lamps, the little side tables, the cabinet with bottles of beer in it, the ornaments, the electric heater, the carpet, everything was stuck upside down to the ceiling. The pictures were upside down on the walls, and the floor they were standing on was absolutely bare. What's more, it had been painted white to look like the ceiling.
"Look," screamed Mrs. Twit. "That's the floor. The floor is up there. This is the ceiling. We're standing on the ceiling."
"We're upside down," gasped Mr. Twit. "We must be upside down. We're standing on the ceiling looking down at the floor."
"Oh, help!" screamed Mrs. Twit. "Help, help, help! I'm beginning to feel giddy."
"So am I, so am I," cried Mr. Twit. "I don't like this one little bit."
"We're upside down, and all the blood's going to my head," screamed Mrs. Twit. "If we don't do something quickly, I shall die. I know I will."
"I've got it," cried Mr. Twit. "I know what we'll do. We'll stand on our heads. Then anyway, we'll be the right way up."
So they stood on their heads, and of course, the moment the tops of their heads touched the floor, the sticky glue that the ravens had brushed on a few moments before did its job. They were stuck. They were pinned down, cemented, glued, fixed to the floorboards. Through a crack in the door, the monkeys watched. They jumped right out of their cage the moment the twits had gone inside, and the roly-poly bird watched, and all of the other birds flew in and out to catch a glimpse of this extraordinary sight. That evening, Mugglewump and his family went up to the big wood on top of the hill, and in the tallest tree they built a marvelous treehouse. All the birds, especially the big ones, the crows and the rooks and the magpies, made their nests around the treehouse so that nobody could see it from the ground.
"You can't stay up here forever, you know," the roly-poly bird said.
"Why not?" said Mugglewump. "It's a lovely place."
"Just you wait till the winter comes," the roly-poly bird said. "Monkeys don't like cold weather, do they?"
"They most certainly don't," cried Mugglewump. "Are the winters so very cold over here?"
"It's all snow and ice," said the roly-poly bird. "Sometimes it's so cold a bird will wake up in the morning with his feet frozen to the bough that he's been roosting on."
"Then what will we do?" cried Mugglewump. "My family will all be deep-freezed."
"No, they won't," said the roly-poly bird, "because when the first leaves start falling from the trees in the autumn, you can all fly home to Africa with me."
"Don't be ridiculous," Mugglewump said. "Monkeys can't fly."
"You can sit on my back," said the roly-poly bird. "I shall take you one at a time. You will travel by the roly-poly super jet, and it won't cost you a penny."
And down here in the horrid house, Mr. and Mrs. Twit are still stuck upside down to the floor of the living room.
"It's all your fault," yelled Mr. Twit, thrashing his legs in the air. "You're the one, you ugly old cow, who went hopping around shouting, 'We're upside down, we're upside down.'
And you're the one who wanted to stand on our heads so we'd be right way up, you whiskery old warthog,"
screamed Mrs. Twit.
"Now we'll never get free. We'll be stuck here forever."
"You may be stuck here forever," said Mr. Twit, "but not me. I'm going to get away."
Mr. Twit wiggled and squirmed, and he squiggled and wormed, and he twisted and turned, and he choggled and churned, but the sticky glue held him to the floor just as tightly as it had once held the poor birds in the big dead tree. He was still as upside down as ever, standing on his head. But heads are not made to be stood upon. If you stand on your head for a very long time, a horrid thing happens, and this was where Mr. Twit got his biggest shock of all. With so much weight on it from above, his head began to get squashed into his body. Quite soon it had disappeared completely, sunk out of sight in the fatty folds of his flabby neck.
"I'm shrinking," burbled Mr. Twit.
"So am I,"
cried Mrs. Twit.
"Help me! Save me! Call a doctor!" yelled Mr. Twit. "I'm getting the dreaded shrinks!"
And so he was. Mrs. Twit was getting the dreaded shrinks, too, and this time it wasn't a fake. It was the real thing. Their heads shrank into their necks, and their necks began shrinking into their bodies, and their bodies began shrinking into their legs, and their legs began shrinking into their feet. And 1 week later, on a nice sunny afternoon, a man called Fred came round to read the gas meter. When nobody answered the door, Fred peeped into the house, and there he saw, on the floor of the living room, two bundles of old clothes, two pairs of shoes, and a walking stick. There was nothing more left in the world of Mr. and Mrs. Twit. And everyone, including Fred, shouted, "Hooray!" You've been listening to The Twits by Roald Dahl, published by Alfred A. Knopf of New York. Northern Storyteller is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our program is coordinated by Ron Inouye. Our engineer is Robert Gilfillan, and the executive producer is Carla Tanella. I'm Ron Clark.